Hi, good morning. This is Holger Ernst speaking. I'm professor of technology and innovation management at WHU Otto Beisheim School of Management in Germany, and you are listening to IP Fridays.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of IP Fridays. Our names are Ken Suzanne and Rolf Clayson, and this is the podcast dedicated to intellectual property. It does not matter where you are from, in-house or private practice, novice or expert. We will help you stay up to date with current topics in the fields of trademarks, patents, design and copyright, discover useful tools, and much more.
Welcome to episode 97 of IP Fridays. Today's interview guest is Holger Ernst of WHU, Otto Beisheim School of Management, and we will talk about patent management and artificial intelligence and much more. But before we jump into the interview, I have some news for you. Lego has sent a cease and desist letter to YouTuber Thomas Panke. He is a big fan of Lego, actually, and he is posting videos about Lego products for a long time now. Now, he has a logo of a blue Lego brick with three knobs of Lego, and Lego has now sent a cease and desist letter to this YouTuber in order to enforce their trademark of Lego. They see that he infringes the trademark by using the Lego name in his logo. And as you can imagine, this has been quite a wrong move by Lego, because sometimes communication is better than legal enforcement. A big shitstorm ensued in Germany, and Lego has a lot of trouble fighting this shitstorm. So if you are thinking about enforcing your trademark and you see there might be a problem with social media or with public resentment, sometimes communicating is better than enforcing. Yesterday, the USPTO has published a short memo regarding funding and the shutdown of the government in the US. They say that funding should be sufficient for patent operations to last until at least the second week in February and trademark operations to last until at least mid-April 2019. So let's see if the government shutdown can be ended before the second week in February. Now let's jump into the interview with Professor Ernst. Today's guest is Professor Dr. Holger Ernst. If you don't know who Holger is, he is currently serving as Chair of Technology and Innovation Management in WHU Otto Beisheim School of Management in Germany, and he is holding this position since 2000. He studied business at Kiel University and University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's also giving customized individual trainings for larger Fortune 500 companies, and he's also visiting professor at Kellogg School of Management of Northwestern, and among many other things. Thank you for being on the show.
You're very welcome, Rolf. Looking forward to chatting with you.
Yes, you have published quite a few articles about IP management, and in particular patent management, and also you have created a tool, PatentSight, quite a while ago, and you have sold this tool last year to LexisNexis, as far as I know. So let's start with the general IP management strategies. What has changed in the recent years, and how does IP management look today compared to a couple of years ago?
Yes, thank you very much for the question. Well, that's really a big one, and I might take a little while to answer that question. So historically, we wouldn't even talk about IP management or IP departments in companies, because there was an exclusive focus on patents only. We had classic patent departments, and they were mainly focused on the administration of patent filings, remunerating inventors. The approach was very, very much reactive, mostly inventor-driven, and the outcome were patent filings, And the key performance indicator of those activities, the number of patents filed. There was hardly any explicit link with the corporate strategy. Patent strategies didn't really exist, and no one really asked the question, what are we getting out of that in terms of strategic or financial value created out of those patent filings? There was hardly any accountability. Again, no one really looking at ROI of the investments in patents and outcomes, hardly any top management exposure, and the focus was mainly on legal aspects, but not so much on financial or strategic aspects. We know from our own empirical research that the number of patents a company owns is not correlated with any relevant financial or strategic performance measures. So you can't argue the more patents you own, the better it is for the company. What really matters is how you manage strategically your portfolio of patents, and not only patents, your entire portfolio of intellectual property, also including other IP regimes such as trademarks. And today, the situation has fundamentally changed. Today, we have strategic IP management departments that focus on the comprehensive management of multiple IPs, including patents, over the life cycle of products to really maximize the strategic and financial value out of the entire IP created by an organization. Companies have explicit IP strategies. They really link them with their corporate and business strategies. There is accountability, top management exposure, where IP departments need to showcase that the outcome really creates value to the company. So it's not so much more about the administration of patent filings. The focus really is on creating a high impact IP portfolio and looking for multiple ways to increase the financial and strategic returns from those kind of investments. The approach is proactive, strategic. The IP department is highly embedded in the entire organization, so they had to overcome the silo mentality. They're interacting with multiple parts in the organization, whether it's marketing, R&D, innovation processes, and they're using new tools like analytics to showcase to the top management what they have achieved, for example, by benchmarking their IP portfolio against competitors. And the key performance indicator today is value, patent value, IP value, in terms of creating value to firms and not so much just the number of patents a company owns. And there is very, very strong accountability and top management exposure, because top management has understood that IP is a very important vehicle to achieve competitive advantage. And the IP department, through new method tools and KPIs, is able to showcase their contribution to important value dimensions top management is looking for. So today, the situation has fundamentally changed over the last 10 years. Sorry for the long answer, but it was a big question.
Ah, yes, of course. That was the goal. So you talk about the financial return of patents, or how what the value of patents is. The value of patents can either be, you know, measured in dollars by selling the patent to someone, or licensing out a patent, or prohibiting competitors entering a market. There are numerous different ways that a patent can be of value to the company. How do you translate these more complex functions of a patent, for example, keeping competitors out of a certain market, in money, in dollars, in euros? I mean, selling a patent, of course, is clear that the price of the patent will be the value of the patent. But there are so many other more complex functions of a patent where the patent can have value for the company. How do you measure the value?
So fundamentally, you're absolutely right. Patents can create value to the firm through numerous ways, and you mentioned the most common ones. And now you're asking me a little bit about the real value of patents, particularly from, if I understand you correctly, the internal use of patents to protect own products or innovations companies have on the market. And here, the real strategic and financial value comes into the picture. When companies have, and the real value driver is successful innovations on the markets customers are willing to pay for. Innovations that create value to customers, that set the innovation apart from other products out in the market, where companies can really charge premium prices. And that's where the patent, if you protect that, to allow companies to charge high prices for very, very valuable products that excite customers, that's where the real financial value of patents comes in, because they protect valuable innovations consumers are paying for in the market. A great example is Dyson, who really came up with the backless vacuum cleaners. So this backless vacuum cleaner has great value propositions to customers. That is why it became a very successful innovation out in the market. And Dyson protects the key functionalities that create value to customers through patents. And actually, you can find those patents on the Dyson website, and you can actually assign them to the innovation, the backless vacuum cleaner. And when you now look at the financial performance of James Dyson, you see that the new product, the innovation protected by patents, so it was difficult for others to copy, created superior financial performance in terms of price premiums Dyson can charge and sales and overall revenues of the company. That's where the real value of the IP really comes in, protecting successful innovations companies are making money with on the market. And now, what I have done in my research, and that later led to the Patent Asset Index, which is the fundamental basis of the patent site analytics platform, is to find objective measures of patent value that indirectly reflect what I just talked about. So in the case of James Dyson, when you look at the Patent Asset Index, the objective metric to measure patent quality based on objective criteria like citations and the international scope of patent protection, you can see that James Dyson has a much higher patent asset index, particularly in the area of backless vacuum cleaners in comparison to its competitors. And you could see a direct correlation between innovation, high-value patents as measured by the Patent Asset Index, and superior financial performance. And that is why we believe that this Patent Asset Index is a very good measure of patent quality in an objective way, and can use this to benchmark yourself against competitors. That's very much grounded in my own empirical research, that Patent Asset Index, and it's a really good indicator, an objective indicator you can use to benchmark yourself against competitors. And companies like Siemens, for example, use that indicator to benchmark its positions against competitors in key business areas, in key technologies, and that is reported to the top management on a regular basis to really show how Siemens is doing in terms of patent position vis-a-vis key competitors, and tracking this over time. So you see that link between value indicators and how you can use this now to better manage and plan your portfolio and communicate this to top management.
You just mentioned the analytics tool PatentSight that you created. And of course, there are many other comparable analytics tools on the market. So what, in your opinion, are the most important analytics outcomes or reports that can be valuable to assess the value of the of patents, of IP, and report it to management? What, in your opinion, is the most reliable way to report the value of the IP portfolio to the top management?
I believe that it's very important to use the right kind of metric. So I can give you an example. Company wants to identify new technological trends or disruptive technologies as early as possible in order to change its R&D strategy. Because the longer you overlook certain technological trends, the more dangerous it is. And in the earlier days, patent departments supplied top management with the classic figures and charts showing the number of patents filed in certain areas over time. And what could top management and decision makers see? Almost nothing, because it was just really looking at the needle in the haystack. You had a lot of classic graphs and developments over time, but very often you didn't see much. What is very important is that you put a smart indicator on top of that. For example, the Patent Asset Index really looking at the quality, the value of patents vis-a-vis just the number of patents filed. And suddenly you can see patterns. And suddenly you see new technologies coming up in time. I can give you an example. You could have told the Swiss company Swatch, which is well known to all of us, almost 10 years prior to Apple launching its first smartwatch, that Apple was going to develop a smartwatch based on smart patent analytics, where you look at the quality of patent activity over time. If you had just looked at the numbers of patents filed over time, you would not have seen Apple's move into that area 10 years prior to launching the product. And Apple today is the number one watchmaker, not only in the smartwatch industry, but overall. So in other words, it really depends on the quality of the indicator, the metric you use. Otherwise, analytic tools won't work. And if you have that, you can use this for multiple applications. Now I talked about technological forecasting. But you can use it for the identification of M&A targets. When we talk about IP monetization, you can use this to find potential licensees, organizations that are willing to license your technology, or you can benchmark yourself against competitors to see whether your R&D position has improved. So there are multiple things you can do, and you speak the language of the top management, and that's the real power of those analytic tools. But the quality of the data and looking at the quality of patents does matter. If you just look at patent filings as you used to do this historically, you typically don't see much. Then you have a lot of data, but you have no insights.
You mentioned the patent asset index as the main indicator for the quality of a patent portfolio, but this is to me kind of a black box. I don't know where this patent asset index comes from. Of course, you don't have to reveal your secret sauce how to calculate the patent asset index, but I would be really interested in what are the most important factors that go into this patent asset index. What are the most important factors that determine the value of a patent portfolio or a patent?
Oh, Rolf, this is not a secret. So, no, it's published in an article. You know, in World Patent Information 2011, together with my colleague and other co-founder of PatentSight, Niels, where we really disclose the methodology fundamentally. And we have done also a lot of validation studies, very important to us since we came from a scientific background. We did a lot of studies to validate the patent asset index, showing that there's a huge correlation between the patent asset index and some of the value dimensions, Rolf, you mentioned earlier, for example, licensing income, whether you were able to survive litigation, or asking companies, look, what are your most important patents protecting your innovations on the markets? And all these, or what are your most important patents? And all these kind of metrics correlate very well with our patent asset index. So this is an objective indicator, but it's very much correlated with the real value drivers and dimension we talked about earlier. So the two main dimensions of the patent asset index are technology relevance and market coverage. Technology relevance, and those are the two typical dimensions we use in innovation research to assess the value of innovations. So the idea is you have to have a superior technology, but it's also important how big the market is the technology actually can address. And that is why we combine those two dimensions. And technology relevance is dimension one, and this is a citation-based indicator. So the fundamental idea is the more a patent family gets cited, the more important it is. But it's not as trivial as that. We correct for a lot of systematic distortions. For example, the age of the patent. Older patents get cited more often than younger patents, so that would create a systematic bias. Citation patterns vary across technology fields and patent offices. So we correct for those systematic distortions to calculate technology relevance for a patent family. Market coverage is the second dimension, and that is based on understanding the legal status of a patent around the world. So, for example, if you have a granted patent in a particular market, we would calculate the market coverage based on the fact that you have a granted and valid a live patent, and then we would weigh this according to the size of the market. The idea is small markets like Please forgive me when I mention Austria is not as big as the US market or the Chinese market. So a granted and valid Austrian patent would get a lower weight than a granted valid patent you have in the US. The weight comes from the size of the market, for example, the gross national product, or if you have other information on the size of the market, you can weigh this accordingly. And then we multiply relevance and coverage at the family level, very important, not at the portfolio level, but at the family level. That gives you the competitive impact, the importance of a patent family, and now you can sum this up over the entire portfolio, over technology fields or product fields or even inventors to come up with a patent asset index. So overall, the patent asset index is a combination of quantity and quality, looking at the size of the portfolio and weighing this with its average quality, the competitive impact. And that, as I mentioned earlier, we have validated and found out that this correlates very, very, very strongly with important dimensions of financial, strategic, and legal value of a patent family.
I have a question for the market coverage factor. You mentioned that the size of the market is important, of course. Yeah. China is much bigger than Austria and India is much bigger than Austria. But do you also take into account the enforceability in these countries? For example, it might be more difficult for a foreigner to enforce a patent in India than in Germany.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I know this very well. No, but we don't do that because very difficult to get that kind of information and make that kind of assessment. So we need to understand that kind of limitation. The patent asset index, it's not a legal assessment, nor does it put a dollar or euro value on the patent. What we have found is the patent asset index correlates with, for example, we have done a validation study where we show that patents with a high patent asset index survive litigation in a very, very successful way. So patents with a high patent asset index are much stronger to enforce and will survive litigation more likely than other patents. It also then shows that patents with a high patent asset index obviously did disturb the competition and they were trying to get away of those kind of patents, but they couldn't because they were strong. So that is some kind of indication that patents with a high patent asset index also have a much stronger legal value. But we do not, make a full legal assessment. That's what the patent asset index can't do. So that is why we don't really have that specific information.
Right. Okay, I understand. But as I understand, the patent asset index is a really great tool to compare the portfolios of different companies and compare your own portfolio to your competitors or patents to your competitors and so on.
Yeah, it's scientifically well proven. Yeah. And maybe as a piece of information, the European Commission just used the patent asset index to make an approval on the big merger in the chemical industry between Dow and DuPont. And they disclosed that and they said how they used our methodology to assess the impact of the merger on the future market structure in terms of innovation. And they had to make that assessment how the merger will impact future innovation. And for that, you need to measure innovation, technology-based innovation. And they used our metric and they cleared the merger under certain conditions where Dow DuPont had to divest certain parts of the business. And the whole analysis was actually done based on the patent asset exit methodology because the EU Commission believed that whatever there is, that seems to be the most valid approach to measure technology-based innovation in the chemical industry because it is scientifically proven. So it seems to be a good method.
Very impressive.
Thank you.
I want to turn to a different aspect completely unrelated to these analytics. In the beginning, you mentioned that it is very important nowadays compared to earlier days to have a cross-functional team, IP team, where the trademark team talks to the design team, talks to the patent team, talks to the marketing people, talks to the communications people, to the financial guys in the in a company. So how does that impact the value of the IP portfolio, the value of the company, in your opinion? And how does that work in practice, like in daily life of a patent department or an IP department?
This is a very important question, and let me focus on two aspects. Well, first of all, we have done also a scientific study where we looked at the integration and collaboration of the IP function with research and development, with the new product development team throughout the new product development process, and how this affects the outcome of a new product development project in terms of market share, financial success. And what we found is the higher the collaboration of the IP function with R&D and also with marketing in new product development, particularly for highly innovative products, and the stronger the contributions of the IP department along the process, the more successful is the innovation that comes out of that new product development process. So this clearly proves that the contribution of the IP department along the entire new product development process is absolutely critical. In the earlier days, the IP department or the patent department came in very late. People were thinking about patent protection towards the end of the process, just before the product would hit the market. Now, the IP function is involved very early in the process to define technologies, look at what competitors are doing, linking what customers may want to a proper patent a position that can be achieved, and then R&D later builds on them. So today, in modern companies, the IP function is deeply involved into the process right from the beginning, and from an organizational setup, very often for important innovative products, IP people are part of those cross-functional new product development teams right from the beginning. This is very, very important. And the second part, and you mentioned that in your question, is the trademark issue. And what we know from aspirin, or now a recent case is Nespresso. For Nespresso, all the patents have expired, but what remains is the brand. But you need time to build the brand. And the time where you can enjoy exclusivity on the market, so Nespresso invented the capsuled coffee market. They had the key patents, and they were on the market alone for many years, and they used that to build a very, very, very strong brand. And today, once the patents have expired, the brand does protect Nespresso. And that's very important. Those integrated IP strategies, as you can see over the life cycle of the product. The functional protection will expire through patents, but then the brand will take over, and ideally the brand will have indefinite life. This does not protect the function, but it's a source identifier. It's Nespresso, it's the brand. But it has to be built through patents and branding, marketing, advertising, new product development. And here you see that then the IP department, to make those strategy work, also needs to interact with branding, marketing, sales, to build this brand while you enjoy exclusivity. If you do this too late, then those kind of value transfer and strategy, as we call them, do not work. By the way, we published a paper in California Management Review where we talk about this value articulation a framework together with my friend James Conley from the Kellogg School of Management, where we showcase Nespresso and other cases in other industries, also in pharmaceuticals, how these value transference integrated IP strategies do work over the entire lifetime of the product. And that is a very, very important approach, and that shows that IP today is not restricted to the silo patent department, but has a much broader exposure to other parts of the organization. And that is why this high organizational embeddedness with other parts of the company, R&D, new business development, marketing, branding, is very, very core and very, very important. And as we all know, brand value very often is very important to the overall value of the firm. If you look at the Interbrand assessment study every year, you see how important from a monetary standpoint the brand is, and here you see how IP contributes to this in a very, very significant way.
In the end of this interview, I want to turn to a controversial topic. artificial intelligence. artificial intelligence, we just talked about how the patent departments or how the IP departments will make their life easier in the future, and how they have to work together and how they have a cross-functional team, basically. But how does artificial intelligence make the life easier of the applicants, of the patent holders, and how will AI disrupt the legal market, the patent attorneys market, in your opinion?
Well, if this is a big question, and it's always difficult to predict the future. No,
we
know a lot of examples where so-called experts were completely wrong in predicting the future. For example, in the case of personal computers and so forth. So I need to be very, very careful about this. But I'm sure artificial intelligence will have a huge impact. When we look at the existing analytics tools, they are smart, given what we have done in the past, but when you really look at the potential of artificial intelligence, I can see a very different analytics approach, where you can get much more meaningful insights out of the vast amount of patent data based on real artificial intelligence, which is going to make it much easier for users to really find insights in a much more effective and efficient way than what we have been used to in the last 5 to 10 years. So artificial intelligence will have a huge impact on analytics and will make analytics much more powerful in the future. But it is not so easy. It's easier said than done, because the patent data and the language used in patents is more difficult than other areas where we already see a much bigger impact of artificial intelligence. But it's going to have a huge impact on patent analytics. I'm very, very sure about it. We'll see major developments in the next 5 years. What we also see is we have startups like Turbo Patent out there, and their vision is to actually completely digitize the process of filing patents, actually making patent attorneys obsolete. So that's the vision behind it. And as far as I know, they already have certain products and tools out there, and they have customers. So I see a huge impact of AI technologies also on the classic activities of patent attorneys and, let's say, old-fashioned patent departments. But that means that patent attorneys and also old-fashioned patent departments need to move into the future and understand that their real value contribution in the firm may not necessarily be just the filing process and the documentation and inventory enumeration, but the real value contribution lies in those areas we talked about in this interview. So in that sense, also patent attorneys and patent departments or IP departments need to change and move into those new areas. Then they shouldn't worry about artificial intelligence. It's going to be an enabler, but they need to also move into the future. That's my recommendation.
Yes, of course. And I completely agree with you. So we have covered a really broad range of topics, and I guess that the listeners will have tons of questions for you. Where would they be able to reach you best?
Well, the best is just to send me an email at hernst@w.edu anytime. I'm happy to answer all kinds of questions. Just shoot me an email, and you also find all my contact details also online on the WHU webpage. But sending me an email is the easiest.
Well, Holger, thank you very much for this super interesting interview. Thank you for being on the show.
Not at all. It was a great pleasure. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity, Rolf.
That's it for this episode. If you liked what you heard, please show us your love by visiting ipfridays.com/love. And tweet a link to this show. We would be so grateful if you would do that. It would help us out to get the word out. Also, please subscribe to our podcast at ipfridays.com or on iTunes or stitcher.com. If you have a question or want to be featured in one of the upcoming episodes, please send us your feedback at ipfridays.com/feedback. Also, please leave us a review on iTunes. You can go to ipfridays.com/iTunes, and it will take you right to the correct page on iTunes. If you want to get mentioned on this podcast or even have comments within the next episode, please leave us your voicemail at ipfridays.com/voicemail. You have been listening to an episode of IP Fridays. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, their respective law firms. None of the content should be considered legal advice. The IP Fridays podcast should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The contents of this podcast are intended for general informational purposes only, and you are urged to consult your own lawyer on any specific legal questions. As always, consult a lawyer or patent or trademark attorney. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved.